It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, a leaked draft opinion shows there's likely enough support in the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. We'll talk to this about the significance of the leak and what it tells us about the future of abortion rights in the United States. Now, in an effort to produce more protective gear at the start of the pandemic, the federal government gave out contracts to businesses who promised to produce or obtain those products, things like hospital-grade N95 masks, among other things. Many of those businesses had never dealt with medical equipment or masks before. Some never followed through with their contracts or tried to pass off inferior equipment as the real deal. Our next guest investigated many of the companies involved and the chaotic effort by government agencies that helped make fraud possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how all this happened? Were you in an agency, a hospital, a health clinic that was trying to get your hands on things like masks and other protective gear in the early days of the pandemic? What kind of things did you run across? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David McSwain is a ProPublica reporter and author of the new book, Pandemic, Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Let's set the stage a little bit here. Talk about the situation early in the pandemic. We knew we were going to need a lot of these supplies. The federal government didn't have them. Talk about the scramble to try to get this stuff that made so much of this fraud you write about possible.
Yeah, so we had this sort of perfect storm. When COVID hit, we had something like 1% of what we needed in the strategic national stockpile in terms of masks and gloves, sort of as a result of 10 years of sort of political fighting. And on top of that, you had the Trump administration, which was really slow to react to the pandemic and really trying to downplay it. And by the time the federal government tried to catch up, the national strategy really became to throw money at anyone and everyone who claimed they could get their hands on these things. And we saw companies, you know, forming overnight and just a few days later having multi-million dollar contracts with the federal government for things like N95s. And I just started following them around and calling people up, and it set off about a year and a half of reporting into this weird underworld of brokers and investors and people who tried to take the federal government and states for a ride while taxpayers got screwed.
You went for a ride with one of the first people you talked about this, a guy named Robert Stewart Jr. He got this big $30+ million contract to produce 6 million, or not produce, somehow obtain 6 million N95 masks. And he was like a guy. He had no background to this stuff. Tell us how you entered into this story.
Yeah, so this was April 2020. I was trying to find my place in the coverage and decided to follow the money here from Washington, D.C. and started looking at who the some of the bigger contracts were going to, and looked in at the Veterans Administration, which oversees the largest hospital network in the country, where nurses and doctors were scrambling and making their own PPE. And as you said, he had no background in this. So I called him and just asked, how do you have 6 million N95s when no one seems to be able to get these things? And he says, well, yeah, I'm legitimate. I'm the real deal. I'm hopping on a private jet in the morning to oversee their delivery. And I said, that's amazing. Would you mind if I tagged along? And, you know, just hours later, I'm on a private jet. And literally, as we're taking off, he reveals that he doesn't actually have the masks, that we're kind of working on a wing and a prayer. And he's working with these people. He called them buccaneers and pirates, these brokers who were, trying to get rich off of the mad scramble for supplies. And over 36 hours, just came to realize that, he may have been committing a federal crime before my eyes, and the whole thing may have been made up.
What was going on in D.C., in the Veterans Administration, the other federal agencies who were reaching out to people like this and saying, yeah, sure, $34 million contract, get us those masks?
Well, in his case, I came to find out later, it took quite a while to confirm this, he was awarded a $34.5 million contract based on an email. He said, hey, I've got masks. And somebody, a contract officer at the VA said, quote, the guy looks legit. And that's how he got his contract. And we were seeing, just following the contracts at ProPublica, and I tracked these down in the book, that, there was no real vetting going on. Anyone with an LLC and an email address could get a multi-million dollar contract, because we were that desperate, and federal agencies were just panic buying.
And before we get into some of the more outright examples of fraud, even if we stop there, with all these people who, you know, overpromised and delivered nothing. You had states, you had hospitals, you had the federal agencies trying to get this stuff. Were we just creating a market of more and more people creating demand for masks that didn't exist and driving up prices?
Absolutely. I mean, the federal government, and in just that one example we've talked about, signaled to this black market that they were willing to pay almost $6 per mask when they used to cost about a dollar. So that just created this bonanza for middlemen, brokers who wanted in on the action, and that set the price for masks. And you have states and cities and hospitals all competing for the same supplies, which, you know, people are trying to bring in from China to get rich.
Talking to David McSwain about his new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about pandemic fraud, maybe an experience if you were trying to procure for a health clinic, a government agency, whatever, PPE, masks, and more stuff. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's bring on a caller now. Nate is with us in Eau Claire. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a physician and work at a hospital in Eau Claire. We were really completely out of all supplies. We didn't end up buying supplies from, from middlemen from China. I myself had physician friends in China who wanted to send me masks and did send me masks. But, you know, to get them FedEx here was almost $3 or $4 a mask. So on one hand, we can complain that masks were $6, but at the other side of the equation, at least we could buy them. The government was completely unprepared, had done nothing to help us, physicians and hospitals, and left us in the lurch. And basically, you can look at the contracting from the VA and stuff, but that had, you know, they really weren't there to help anybody for 9 months or a year. We were all on our own and lucky to buy masks at $6 each and could hardly get them.
Nate, thanks so much for sharing that experience. David, there are probably thousands of Nates around the country in that same boat at that time, right?
Right, yeah. So you're left to navigate this sort of shady underworld. It's lucky that Nate had some connections with folks in China. Most places didn't know how to navigate that, and they were waiting on the federal government to get it together.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Nate, at 800-642-1234. That China connection, David, you looked at different operations who were trying to bring in masks from China. Can you tell us about one? I think this was in Texas where they brought the masks, but they changed the labels through the process.
Right. So to fill the gap, the FDA and the CDC sort of put together this really haphazard system where they were approving certain masks, the KN95s, you know, the Chinese version. Which, you know, generally aren't as good. Their efficacy was always sort of questionable. And, you know, people saw an opportunity. If they could bring in those KN95s, they could also make money. The problem was a lot of them were nowhere near the 95% filtration rate of an actual N95. And in fact, many were pretty lousy. And in Texas, I found a ring of guys who were using Venmo and TaskRabbit paying each other to take subpar masks out of their packaging that clearly stated not for medical use and put them into different packaging so that they could pass muster with Texas hospitals. And just following Venmo, I was able to see how these folks were paying each other for repackaging, to try to get in on the frenzy.
You met some of the people running these operations, some who had worked for them through TaskRabbit and some who had left once they realized it was pretty sketchy. Talk about, how did they talk about this? Did they say, yeah, I'm doing kind of this scam, but it's cool? Or did they not realize they were doing something bad?
I mean, some folks did realize that it was bad. I mean, that's how I came to know about the story. Somebody had told a friend who told me. But one of the central figures in that effort down there in San Antonio really didn't seem to think it was much of a problem. You know, he just thought it was a matter of cutting through some red tape. And I said, you know, these are destined for nurses and doctors. It seems pretty important that they know whether or not they're medical grade or not, because at this point we don't have a vaccine and hospitals are overrun, particularly in Texas at that point in time. And it seemed, as I was explaining my concern, he slowly started to realize that maybe he'd been involved in something shady, and he eventually stopped talking to me.
And there are so many details in your book that are kind of funny. I mean, apart from, you know, the potential health consequences, you mentioned Venmo, if I don't use Venmo, but if I did, there's a thing I can do where I can make my notes private. All the people in these shady dealings in that story you just told, you were able to track down where they're taking things from and to because they left their notes public.
God bless them. They left it public and even post some on social media. That app has since changed it so that it's a little bit harder to track other people's public transactions, which is a shame.
We're talking to David McSwain, ProPublica reporter, author of the book Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. He's talking with us about how some people use the COVID-19 pandemic as a way to secure business contracts and make money, in some cases through outright fraud. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there should be more accountability for people involved in these contracts? We'll get into what has happened to some of them in just a few moments. Do you have an experience? Were you on the hunt for some of these products on the secondary, sometimes dubious market for personal protective equipment and masks back in early 2020? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with David McSwain, ProPublica reporter, author of the new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. David's talking to us today about pandemic fraud. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, maybe your experiences with trying to get equipment for a clinic, a hospital, whatever the case may be, 800-642-1234, back during the early days of the pandemic. David, one of the most fascinating people in your book was not one of the fraudsters, but a longtime mask manufacturer who had been sounding the alarm about our depleted stockpile of masks and kept trying to help through the pandemic. Can you share a little of his story with us?
Yeah, Mike Bowen, along with a business partner down near Dallas, Texas, ran a factory called Prestige Ameritech, which makes homegrown N95 respirators and surgical masks. And he'd been warning through letters and phone calls for over 13 years, three different administrations, really spelling out that if we were hit with a pandemic, China would cut off supply. Everything had been outsourced for cheaper labor and costs in China. They would choke that off, and you know, Americans would needlessly die. He'd been calling for the stockpile to beef up its investment in domestic manufacturing for that reason. And what was amazing about his story is he realized before almost anyone that we were in trouble, because this obscure corner of his website where the company sold N95s in smaller cases was blowing up, and they saw sales shooting through the roof. It looked like Chinese Americans might be sending these back home to China and Hong Kong. And he sounded the alarm, started telling people in Washington, and nearly got the ball rolling. But some politics here in Washington got in the way. But if we had listened to Mike Bowen, we would have had supplies and we would have had them earlier.
Another concern you raise in the book was that some politically connected figures were able to get pretty juicy contracts out of the White House and some federal agencies. What did you find?
I found that Peter Navarro, President Trump's trade advisor, who was behind some of his trade war efforts, had done something really remarkable. He essentially inserted himself into federal purchasing. He was one of the few in the administration to really sound the alarm early on. But he was also a China hawk and just this character. And he just started directing contracts to people who he was connected to, or to people who had a line to the White House. So you have that sort of patronage stuff going on. At the same time, you have desperate agencies giving contracts out to anybody and everyone. So some of the people like Mike Bowen, who probably should have been hired and brought into the fray early, were on the sidelines as we were messing around with companies that had political connections or had no business at all getting a contract.
Among those were some companies where the owners had a history of various kinds of business fraud. How easy was it for people with a track record of doing fraud to get these contracts?
Incredibly easy. There's one company I detail in the book called Filikit LLC. This company formed in late April or early May 2020. 6 days later, got a $10 million deal with the Federal Emergency Management Agency for test tubes. And these were the PCR tests, still very early, crucial weeks where we need to catch up on testing to get ahead of the virus. And we looked into the company. They had no history of medical supplies, so we immediately questioned their product. But the owner actually had a history of fraud allegations against him and had been sued by federal agencies, in fact, for that alleged fraud. And long story short, we put it into a story, and I end up visiting the warehouse down in Houston, and I approach after sort of staking the place out, and I can see that this company has temp workers using literal snow shovels rounding up these quote-unquote test tubes, which aren't test tubes at all. They're actually mini soda bottle preforms that are blown up with heat and pressure to create your 2-liter soda bottles at the grocery store. And it's being done in these unsanitary conditions where fans are whipping things around, people aren't wearing masks. These tests are unusable. And when I told FEMA what I'd seen, they had been distributed to all 50 states and territories. FEMA had to tell those states and territories not to use those test kits. And it set back testing during those really crucial weeks where we were struggling to catch up on the virus. And because the federal government accepted the tubes, even though they were useless, that company got paid. And contract experts tell me it's hard to make a case that they should give the money back.
Talking to David McSwain about his new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. So, David, that company didn't see any accountability. Did others? Did anybody get successfully charged, imprisoned with fraud? I know at least one key story in your book that is what happened.
Yes. Robert Stewart Jr., the man with the private jet who sort of set me off on this quest, was eventually charged with 3 federal crimes and, you know, is in prison for his crimes, including defrauding some other government programs where, you know, a lot of people did get away with it. It was, you know, but people who just didn't deliver things, they lost their contracts. But where we're seeing a lot of action now is within the Paycheck Protection Program, where people who own businesses lied on a few forms and were able to get millions of dollars within days. Hundreds of people have been charged for defrauding that program. We saw a lot of fraud in the unemployment benefits program as well. And, you know, President Biden in his State of the Union address announced that he was setting up a special prosecutor to investigate pandemic fraud. So, but each one of those has to be its own case where law enforcement gets involved and, you know, the wheels of justice are slow. So we're going to be catching up to this for years.
Yeah, what is the current state now of investigations of these companies that ripped off the government in one way or another?
You know, it's unclear. It's slow moving. Congress is looking into some of these companies, including several that I detail in the book. And we're seeing more reports, you know, every other month or so coming out on that. And as I said, there is a larger federal effort to catch up to the fraud because we're still in this thing. And, you know, the Biden administration was really focused on vaccine deployment and all those other things. So fraud sort of took a back seat.
What kind of lessons are you hoping people learn from the stories you report on?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, that this book is a blueprint of exactly what we shouldn't do when faced with such a crisis. You know, it's amazing to me that we only had 1% of what we needed in the stockpiles when COVID hit. We had clear warnings that we didn't heed. Our politics got in the way. I think those are some really simple things that we can address. We could put guardrails up on programs like the Paycheck Protection Program. That program, you know, by design, by Congress's design, place speed above everything else. So money was just flying out the door, something like $800 billion in forgivable loans with almost no oversight and no incentive for banks and other lenders to vet the claims of these business owners. And as a result, we had this massive cleanup effort. So I think we need to think about those guardrails on how you release spending, who you contract with, make sure we're prepared so that we don't end up in a situation where our national well-being is in the hand of mercenaries ever again.
We've been talking about a lot about the money, eventually, I guess, wasted by the government on a lot of these companies, money made by some of these people who ran these things. How about the impact, though, on health? How much did these fraudulent efforts hamper our reaction to the pandemic?
You know, the cause effect there is always going to, you know, we're never really going to pin that down because this was so big, so massive, and so messy. You know, but what we do know is all of this fraud, all of this giving contracts to people who had no business getting contracts, the delays in testing, the delays in delivering masks, that all happened when time meant American lives. We needed this stuff and we needed it now, and our doctors and nurses were at risk while people were trying to get rich off of it. So the answer is too much human life was lost while these shenanigans I was following around transpired.
And you had to spend time one-on-one in the offices of some of these people who are committing various kinds of fraud, or in one case, a private plane. What are they like? What is it like to just hang out with these people who are knowingly, in some cases, semi-knowingly in others, ripping off the American government and endangering health?
Well, you know, I always come in with an open mind. I mean, we never know someone's motivations, and I try to hear people out and see what they say. And, you know, in the case of Robert Stewart Jr. with the private jet, I felt a tension in him, as if he wasn't sure if he was the vaunted American entrepreneur, you know, that is rising to his occasion that we all, you know, sort of admire in this country, or if he in fact was one of the buccaneers and pirates he so decried. In other cases, it was pretty clear, you know, for instance, the test tube company, that owner came out and screamed at me and very threateningly. So you never know how it's going to go. But my job is just to show up and ask questions and see, you know, get as many answers as we can.
In our last 30 seconds or so, do you think that the federal government has learned any lessons for how to do quick procurement of vital supplies?
I certainly hope so. You know, the Biden administration has called for something like $88 billion to be infused into Health and Human Services, which includes the stockpile, the CDC, and other agencies, so that we don't find ourselves in a situation where we have to deal with so much emergency contracting. But at the very least, you know, a quick Google search would have caught plenty of these, you know, these dubious contractors. And certainly you got to think about the effects you're going to have on a market that you can't control. Emergency managers would say this was a time when the government needed to take control through the Defense Production Act and make sure that prices were set and you couldn't price gouge and so forth.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David McSwain, a ProPublica reporter. We've been talking about his new book, Pandemic Inc., Chasing the Capitalists and Thieves Who Got Rich While We Got Sick. He talked to us today about fraudulent companies getting government contracts, big ones, for key pandemic supplies. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. A draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court shows there are probably enough justices ready to overturn the federal right to an abortion. The draft opinion was written by Justice Samuel Alito and leaked to Politico, which published it in full last night. It's important to note the opinion is not the final opinion. Justices could hypothetically change their minds ahead of their ultimate decision this summer. But according to Politico, there's still enough support among the court's conservative justices as of this week to overturn Roe v. Wade. We're talking about the significance of this leak from the Supreme Court and what it would mean if this draft opinion holds. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this news? The likelihood now that Roe v. Wade would be overturned? Do you have questions about how it would affect Wisconsin and other states? Do you think this would be the right decision? Are you glad to see this? Are you worried about it? Do you think Congress should act one way or another on it, or state legislatures? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We're in a unique position here. This is a draft that's been leaked that is not a final decision necessarily. How likely do you think it is, though, that anything different would happen, that at least five justices wouldn't support this, knowing what we know now?
I think it's unlikely. I think one of the interesting issues here is that there's still about 2 months before the court would likely have announced this decision. And in court time, that's quite a bit of opportunity for persuasion on the merits and persuasion on the law. And in fact, that's what happened in 1992 with the Planned Parenthood v. Casey decision, one in which conservatives, particularly those on the court, thought that they had a victory overturning Roe versus Wade. But then we had three individuals peel off, Justices Kennedy, Souter, and O'Connor, and they sort of crafted a compromise agreement to sustain Roe, but create a different legal paradigm. And one wonders whether or not Roberts was hoping to try to do that. Now what's probably happened is it's going to harden those individuals who've already cast a vote, because they're not going to want to look as though they have given ground or were bending to pressure from the public or politicians or even internally in the court. So my suspicion is we've probably locked in the vote at 5-4, and Roberts has probably lost the remaining time that he had to persuade and to maybe move this on the merits so that Roe could be sustained.
What will this mean? If this, in fact, goes through this summer, what then happens in states around the country when it comes to abortion?
So what you're going to see happen is there are several states that have trigger provisions. One's where if Roe versus Wade falls, then automatically some laws go into place banning or restricting abortion rights in those states. Some never technically wiped their legislation from the books, so those would automatically go back into place. And I would suspect that some states that have been on the fence, I'm thinking states like Indiana, might begin to craft some legislation that would deal with the fallout from the decision from the court. And my suspicion is that would start almost immediately. So, you know, you're looking at dozens of states where the rights of women to exercise this privacy right would be fundamentally changed.
And Wisconsin is one of those states in that category. You mentioned we have a law going back to, I think, 1849, never taken off the books. That, in theory, if Roe versus Wade is overturned, that is on the books. It would make abortion, performing an abortion, a felony in all cases except to save the life of the mother, if I understand that correctly, Charlie.
That's my understanding, too. Again, I mean, this has been a long dormant law, and so it may take some reinterpretation, both by actors who have to enforce it, as well as state courts. So while, yes, we have the statute and it is likely to go into effect, if it would comport with what we're expecting the court to say, it may have to be amended slightly. So I'm not exactly sure if as written in it on the books at the moment is what you're going to see in effect if Roe versus Wade does get overturned.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College, looking at the leaked document from the U.S. Supreme Court, likely overturning Roe versus Wade as things stand now, opening up abortion restrictions in states around the country. You can join in with your reaction, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. In this document, Charlie, what is the case made by Justice Alito in terms of the legal rationale for overturning Roe?
Well, the argument that he seems to be making is that it was poorly argued when it was initially offered. And remember that Roe versus Wade was part of a series of cases that began in 1965 with Griswold versus Connecticut. And in the Griswold case, the court was dealing with whether or not a state could prohibit married couples from obtaining some sort of birth control device for themselves. And it was kind of a tortured argument there. And it was then extended to abortion rights in the 1973 case. And so his basic argument is that substantive rights, where you're basically arguing that individuals have a liberty interest to pursue some sort of activity, that these kinds of substantive rights are improper, at least in the context of abortion. And because of poor arguments and poor precedent that followed this particular case, it cannot be sustained. And part of what he's arguing here is there's no long-standing tradition in American history that this is a protected right, because this is a contested area of legislation. And as a result, he wants to return this back to the states so that they can argue as communities about whether or not they want to support and sustain this particular liberty. And so it's a states' rights argument. It's one that's sort of a technical one about either procedural or substantive rights. And so, you know, it's one that can be sustained on the merits. I mean, it's one that has been made ever since Roe versus Wade came down. But at the same time, after 50 years of supporting this particular view, it became almost concrete in sort of the legal venue that this was a right that could be sustained.
And the point has been made, I think, by many at this point, Charlie, that if a current Supreme Court, five justices, could say, no, those seven with Roe v. Wade got it wrong back then by this standard, then the Griswold case you mentioned, saying states, yeah, you can't ban contraception. In that case, I think it was for married couples. Obergefell allowing same-sex marriage. the same standards might apply. A state could pass a law, bring it up to the Supreme Court, and we could see the same arguments used to overturn those?
We could, although apparently Alito is trying to cramp the decision, arguing that it only applies to abortion. And certainly the court can try to do that. But as we've seen with the case like Bush v. Gore that settled the 2000 election, where the court also said this has no precedential value. Courts have used the basic arguments from the court in that case, and there's nothing that's going to stop lower courts or state courts from applying this basic decision to other privacy-related and substantive rights. So you're correct. We're talking about possible bans on contraceptives. We're talking about possible bans on interracial marriage, on gay marriage, on gay sexual autonomy. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of potential for unraveling of rights that Americans have both become accustomed to and have supported over time. And I'll even go back to a case from 1925, where the court, in essence, created a liberty interest in parents being able to educate their children as they see fit, because there was a state law that prohibited sending kids to private schools. You could only have public education, which would have, in essence, banned parochial schools and other religious institutions. So there's lots of cases out there that can be affected. And it's, you know, it's that metaphor about tugging on the piece of yarn on your sweater before you know it, you don't have much of a garment of clothing left.
One list is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, reacting to the draft opinion at a news conference today.
If we had to pick a word that our caucus feels, it's infuriated. Infuriated by the alleged decision, infuriated by the lies these justices told us when they said they'd respect precedent.
It's a strong accusation. Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, also suggested that she'd been misled by a couple of the Supreme Court nominees over the last few years who signed on to this apparent decision. What do you think? Is there a case to be made that they misled in their misled senators in their hearings?
Yeah, it's interesting how, depending upon what party you belong to and your position on the matter, the type of language you're using, misled or lied. So one of the difficulties for anyone who's been nominated to the bench at any level in the federal courts is that you don't want to take a position on any legal issue, because in the American judicial system, decisions are going to be fact dependent. So they have to be able to know what the facts are in the case, what the legal arguments are before they can rule. So to rule on a hypothetical or to speculate about a hypothetical when they're in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee puts them in a very difficult position. And so oftentimes individuals who are, you know, being vetted by the Senate Judiciary Committee will be coy, or they will try to sidestep answering a question directly. I think what's drawing some ire from senators is the question was rather direct to some of these nominees to the bench, both in private and during hearings. And it doesn't seem like they are waffling at all. They were pretty clear. This is standing precedent and we won't overturn it. And that suggests they didn't have a concern about the fact dependency of any case that came before them. I think that's what's really bothering Susan Collins the most, because she seems to have heard both in the hearings and in her office that this would not be overturned. And I think she feels a little bit maybe gullible, a little bit duped by the process.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political scientist at St. Norbert College, looking at the leak of a draft opinion that shows initial support in the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the right to an abortion. It's not the final decision. Theoretically, justices could change their positions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That with your reaction, that's 800-642-1234. What do you think about the possible end of Roe v. Wade? What would you want to see here in Wisconsin? Current law, a very old law on the books, would theoretically come into effect banning almost all abortions. Is that the outcome you are hoping for? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College. With us today to talk about a leaked draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court that shows justices ready to overturn the right to an abortion if that leaked opinion holds. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This could be the end of the Roe versus Wade era. States allowed to enact any restrictions on abortion that state lawmakers see fit. If that's the case, what would you want to see here happen here in Wisconsin? Do you think the Supreme Court is getting it right if this holds? Do you want to see Congress take action one way or another? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, Charlie. Question is in relation to the other constitutional amendments, the freedom of speech, right to bear arms, and this draft opinion. How are the parallels, or is there any parallels between, say, the Second Amendment right to bear arms and the limitations that there presently exist on fully automatic weapons, depleted uranium shells, explosive shells, private ownership of anything larger than a half-inch caliber? I mean, does the removal or the language that is in this draft suddenly provide a case or ammunition that basically the NRA could come back and say, well, we want all of these restrictions removed from private ownership of these weapons?
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. I think there it might be a big jump there, Charlie. I mean, it is an enumerated Bill of Rights, right? So that makes it kind of different. I don't know. Do you see any connections there?
Well, actually, there is a connection. And, you know, it's a good question because the foundation for Alito's opinion is suggesting that the reason why the original holding is incorrect is because abortion isn't deeply rooted in our history and our tradition. And this is language that the court has used before. And if this is going to be the new benchmark, it means that using this sort of originalist construction to think about what rights we have under the Constitution, if something isn't deeply rooted in our tradition, then it might not be protected. So as sort of a hypothetical away from the Second Amendment, you could think of something like cruel and unusual punishment and what type of punishments were deeply rooted in our tradition and what might not be acceptable now, or in what ways do we protect the rights of individuals from warrantless searches and seizure? Because there was a famous case from the 50s called Rochin v. California, where to get evidence, they forcibly pumped the person's stomach. So if these kinds of things were permissible in the past and deeply rooted, then they may come back. But other things that are protecting us now might disappear because it isn't deeply rooted. And so to his point about some of these new munitions, well, they might actually get banned under the same kind of thinking because they weren't part of the construct of weaponry back in the 17th and 18th century. So those are the kinds of things that we can think through, right? This is sort of the slippery slope. We start at the top thinking about Roe in this way, and what kind of other effects is it going to have on other rights? So Mike's right to think about this and think about it this deeply.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Amanda now in Madison. Amanda, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and thanks for the conversation. Speaking on the sort of long-term effects of, like, if this were to be overturned, what does that mean long-term? Has the court offered up anything in this draft for, like, resources available to people who wouldn't be able to get the service, or sort of, like, what's the long-term plan? If we're taking this healthcare away, then what, I guess, what do people look forward to as far as other resources?
Amanda, thanks for the call. We're going to talk about that more on the show tomorrow. Actually, Charlie, does the Supreme Court look at those outcomes that Amanda's talking about, women giving birth who hadn't planned to?
I would say actually the opposite from Alito's opinion, because this sort of states' rights stance that he's taking suggests we return this to the states. They create some parameters, which is you can ban this procedure except when it affects the life of the pregnant woman, which means that, in essence, all shackles are off about the regulation of this particular process. So what you can expect is what your state legislature will do to constrain or expand the right to abortion. Some states that want to ban it, at least partially, may still offer an avenue to women. Others may be a little bit more significant in the way in which they restrict banning it outright at any moment, except maybe to save the life of a woman, which could include, you know, issues of incest or rape or impregnation of a really young person that they would have to carry to term. So all of this is hypothetical and speculation on my part. It's going to be state dependent, and it's going to depend on what the final language of the final opinion will be from the court.
Amanda, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Lloyd joins us now in Greenfield. Lloyd, hi.
Yeah, hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lloyd?
Well, I told your screener that I think that the whole Roe v. Wade thing should be overturned. I think abortions are completely wrong. I don't think they should be allowed, period. The only possible exception would be if the mother potentially could die as a result. All the baloney about women's rights and so on is just that, baloney, because women have the choice not to get pregnant to begin with, but they do not have the right to kill another human being. And if you look at the laws, it says that if some guy attacks a woman who's pregnant and the fetus dies, well, guess what? He gets charged with killing it because it's a person. And there's no reason why an abortionist should be able to kill a person.
Lloyd, thanks for the call. Charlie Lloyd sums up the argument against abortion rights.
And, you know, there are some persuasive legal arguments about allowing, because this is not a specific right in the Constitution, like speech, like free exercise of religion, that it's something that should be left to the decision of majorities. But, you know, part of the, you know, structure and function of the American system of government that we can read quite extensively in the Federalist Papers and other places by our founders is, you know, the hope to protect minority rights in a whole scope of issues, not just abortion. And so we have to balance majoritarianism and the pursuit of a majority's right to control various aspects of our lives against a minority's ability to make their own decisions apart from the imposition of the will by the majority. It's a very difficult argument to have. And, you know, this is one of those ones that has been a touchstone for our politics and our debate for so many years in the United States. And it's one that's not going to be solved whether the court sustains or overturns Roe versus Wade.
Thanks for the call, Lloyd. Patricia joins us now in Kaukauna. Patricia, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So the question I have is specifically about the life of the mother. My understanding is that if Roe versus Wade is overturned, instantly in Wisconsin, we'll be in a situation where abortion will be illegal to perform unless the life of the mother is at stake, which sounds really clear cut, but it isn't, right? Because after all, like, there are some disorders like blood clotting disorders or, you know, various other disorders which can be triggered by a pregnancy. But it might not cause an immediate, urgent, life-threatening disorder. Who's going to make that call? A court? A doctor? Politicians?
Patricia, thanks for the call. Charlie?
And this is where it's going to get rather tricky with this legislation. Do you need two doctors to agree, one doctor to indicate? When we're talking about the life, as you know, as she suggests, are we talking about mental health, physical health, long-term health, or effects that might not be immediate? So these kinds of things have to be grappled with. I mean, some of the more limiting laws that we've seen, in essence, suggest if the woman would die and die because you take the child to term. And so these are the kinds of things that are the unintended consequences of overturning a case like Roe versus Wade, and one that we're going to have to see unfold in the various states that want to change their laws if Roe is eventually wiped off the books.
Patricia, thanks for the call. And Charlie, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. He was with us today to talk about a leaked draft opinion in a U.S. Supreme Court case challenging abortion rights. The draft opinion shows a majority of justices ready to overturn the federal right to an abortion. It's not clear if justices will ultimately rule that way. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get more of the fallout from that draft Supreme Court ruling on Roe v. Wade. Find out what it means in states around the country and more opportunities for you to join the conversation with your reactions, your thoughts about what could happen next, the possible consequences if Roe v. Wade is overturned. We've got stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can share your thoughts there as well. Also tomorrow, high demand for housing plus low supply means a lot of people in Wisconsin are scrambling to find a place to live that they can afford to live in. Our guest calls it a perfect storm. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.